by listening, I hope. It is true that I am a teacher in a dual lineage, both Theravada, insight meditation, and Soto Zen. And the teaching today will reflect a blend of my understanding of those traditions in relationship to the topic, which is a small topic, right? What does it mean to be free? And especially, what does it mean to be free here, now, in what the Buddhist tradition would call the Saha world? The Saha world is the world of suffering, the world of difficulty, the world of distress, the world on fire. And how is it that our practice, that our engagement in the meditative practice and the broader practices that Buddhism brings to us can support us in responding to the cries of the world? So we'll be exploring all of that in a very brief time. I'll do my best. And as Caroline said, the general format here is to sit for 30 minutes, give a talk for 30 minutes, and have 30 minutes of discussion and questions. And we'll do that, but I want to invite all of us to consider, as we begin our meditation, that this is also the beginning of the Dharma talk. And that as you listen to the Dharma talk, that the Dharma talk is a continuation of the meditation, because the themes we'll be exploring are quite similar in both. The first part in the meditative practice will be more of an experiential understanding of some of the things that I'll be talking about later. So let's begin. You all probably know how to do this, right? We are going to practice meditating, which is about turning our attention inward to pay attention to be present with what's here. And in our practice, I like to say there are only three things happening. There is awareness, there's what we're aware of, the content of awareness, and there's the relationship between those two things. And again, we'll be unfolding some of that a little bit later. But as we begin our practice, we will be moving through the teaching of the four foundations of mindfulness, which is a way of describing what we pay attention to. So we'll start together with the first foundation of mindfulness, attending to the body and the body breathing. So if you will either close your eyes or have a soft gaze down and take a posture. You could be seated, you could be standing, you could be lying down. You want to take a posture that allows the body to feel a sense of stability and support. There's a sense of uprightness, of dignity, and also a sense of ease. So letting your attention come inward, perhaps imagining you could fill the whole body with your awareness. And noticing what's here, what's true. You might make any adjustments that are helpful and allow your attention, your awareness, your energy to be equally balanced. in front of you and behind you, to the left and the right. Above and below. I like to begin by really feeling the weight of the body, the heaviness of the bones and muscles, letting them, all of that, sink down, rest down. Letting the weight of the body give way to gravity. And feeling the earth element of the body resting on the earth. And as you begin to tune in, listen in to the felt sense of the body here now, really bringing an attitude of openness and receptivity. Opening, receiving, allowing whatever's here. Body may feel heavy and tired, or spacious and light. You may notice the aliveness of the body, tingling, flowing, aching, buzzing. Or perhaps there's a sense of stillness. Connecting with the felt sense of the body as a way to tether the attention to the moment. To come into the present, right here, right now. As you begin to settle into the body, becoming aware the body is breathing. You don't need to force or change the breath in any way. You might notice, where does the breath make itself known in the body as sensation? Can you attend to, stay present with one full cycle of inhalation and exhalation? Just one breath at a time. As you begin to settle and arrive, opening your awareness to notice the rising and passing of sound and of sensation in the body. Some of it pleasant, some of it unpleasant. Beginning to tune in to notice what's called the feeling tone of your experience. And how we tend to lean in to try to grab on to pleasant experience, make it stay or expand it. How we tend to tighten or resist, reject, or try to push away experience that registers as unpleasant. You don't have to change that kind of habitual reactivity, but can you notice? And you become aware of that fundamental reverb in the system, that grasping and pushing away, liking and not liking, a response to pleasant and unpleasant experience. Just as you notice the feeling tone of sound and sensation, you can open your awareness further still. Begin to notice the, they're called the mental states, the whole cacophony of thoughts and feelings. Without needing to change, resist, or try to get rid of anything at all. Just allowing whatever's here to be known, maybe naming or noting. Seeing how thoughts and feelings arise and are known all on their own. Some pleasant, some unpleasant. Our practice is to rest in the body and the breath, and to open and receive it all. And if at any point you notice that you've been swept away, carried down the rabbit hole of a memory or a fantasy, a plan. Just knowing that that moment of noticing is a moment of mindfulness, a moment of waking up. And inviting yourself to return again and again to the immediacy, the felt sense of the breath in the body. Here, now. And finally, inviting you to shift your attention a bit. That rather than noticing the content of awareness, you begin to notice the experience of being aware. How it is that moment by moment, content, sensations, sounds, thoughts and feelings, pleasant and unpleasant experiences arise and are known, and how they fade away all on their own. As you notice the content of awareness, a content of your experience arising and passing, tuning your attention to notice that which is aware. Feeling the body stable, present, like a mountain. And aware of the breath, like a soft breeze. Let the mind, the big mind of awareness, be wide. spacious. Like a vast open sky. Allowing each moment of experience to arise and be known. And letting it pass away. Like clouds moving through a wide open sky. Bringing an attitude of warmth and receptivity. Meeting each moment just as it is, however it is. Whatever comes, let it come. Whatever goes, let it go. And see what remains. So, what does it mean to be free? And how does this practice help? How does it help us respond to the difficulty and the beauty all around. I like to remind all of us that, that this topic of freedom to start is, it is kind of the clarion call of the Buddhist path, right? It's the premise and the promise of what's possible. And the Buddha is one of my favorite descriptions of a scene of the Buddha talking to his disciples. He is reputed to have said, "It is possible. It is possible. If it were not possible, I wouldn't ask you to do it." It's very kind. I imagine that perhaps like some of you, perhaps like how I feel sometimes, his disciples may have been feeling some doubt. You know, really? Is it really possible to wake up and be free here in this world, in the midst of so much divisiveness and violence and pain? And I think it's important to remember that the time of the Buddha was also a time of tremendous upheaval, of difficulty. Sometimes we have a kind of unrealistic, perhaps, or, you know, how when we look back on things, we look through golden lenses somehow, you know, an idea that the Buddha lived in some golden age, but it wasn't true. The time of the Buddha was also a time of tremendous social and political and spiritual upheaval. There was kind of a falling, a failing of the Brahmin caste, which is what was made space for a whole array of these kind of upstart spiritual practices, of which Buddhism was just one. Of course, it wasn't called Buddhism back then. It was just a set of teachings that were being offered by this guy. And this guy lived at a time when there was a lot of fighting. There were a lot of wars. There were famine. The Buddha's own family, the Sakyas, were eradicated. They were knocked out. They were decimated by the neighboring Kolya clan. There was a lot of clan infighting, and it wasn't suffering over there somewhere. It was in close for the Buddha. And yet in the midst of all that, he had the faith, the strength to say, "It is possible." It's helpful for me to remember that, because it's easy to think, well, maybe then, but not now. Right? Buddha didn't have social media. The Buddha couldn't get on a Zoom call, you know, with 100 people from around the world. He couldn't, but he had his own troubles. Right? So, I want to read to you, some of you know this, the opening lines of the Satipatthana Sutta. The Satipatthana Sutta is ostensibly the words of the Buddha. All of the suttas begin with the phrase, "Thus have I heard." This is Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, recalling, remembering. This is what the Buddha said, because nothing was written down for 400 years after the Buddha died, which, you know, did the Buddha really say this? Who knows? But it was valuable enough that people passed it down in an oral tradition for hundreds of years. And finally, it was written down. So here's the opening of this sutta. The Satipatthana means the four foundations of mindfulness. And it is the basis of the structure of the teaching, the meditation teaching that is taught in many, many insight meditation centers and traditions. And it is what we just practiced ourselves, at least part of it. So here's the opening of the sutta. He says, there is a way, a direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of discontent, for the gaining of the true method, for the realization of nibbana, of liberation, of freedom, of peace. So he opens this teaching with a promise. He opens his teaching with a pretty high bar, you know. If you do this path, here's what's possible. And of course, in excuse me, in the modern world, we have kind of dumbed it down a little bit, you know. Like we think, oh, it's good for cutting new neural pathways, or it helps us relax, or it's good for stress reduction or something. And all of that is true and useful. Super helpful in a world where we need stress reduction, where we need places of quiet and of peace, where many of our nervous systems are quite frayed, right? Super helpful. But we don't want to cut the possibility and the potential of the practice off at the knees. We want to remember that what the Buddha was offering, what Buddha's teachings continue to offer, is more than just a self-help technique. So then we have to ask the question, you know, what does it mean? What is nibbana? What is liberation? What does it mean to be free, to live in peace? I don't know if you can hear it, but my little dog is going, rrr. He thinks that when I give a teaching, he gets a treat. So he makes enough noise that it's annoying to me. So I give him a treat and it'll last about 3 seconds. This is a demonstration of us as human beings. We think we're different, but we're not. We just wait to get our treat and we think it's going to make us happy. And it does for about 3 seconds. In his case, it's about 3 minutes, and then he's done with the treat and he wants another one. This is just like us. I'll get to that in a minute. So, what does it mean to be free? I would say that if you scratch a dozen Dharma teachers, you'll get a dozen different answers. So this is mine today. It might be different a year from now or 10 years from now, but I'm offering it in the hope that it will be helpful. And I think it's useful to begin by talking about what freedom isn't. Because I think that we are confused as humans about what it means to be free. Just as we're confused about what it means to wake up, we're often confused about what meditation is about or is for. So the first thing is to say that being free is not a heightened state of consciousness. It's not some special state that we get to. That's not freedom. And the reason we know that it's not freedom is because those states come and go, don't they? Freedom is something enduring. Freedom is something that is deeper, that cuts beneath the coming and going, right? Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, who founded San Francisco Zen Center, where I practice, he said, enlightenment is not an experience. Try that on for a little while. That's our usual mind. That's how we think. Our usual mind thinks, I'm looking for a particular kind of experience. That's not what freedom is. Now, I will say that if you practice meditation, you may have all kinds of experiences, as the Buddha did, and as many, many meditation practitioners do. There are all kinds of states of consciousness that are available. Some of them are extraordinary. Some of them are very simple and quiet. Some of them are super helpful, you know, states of concentration that tend to calm and soothe the nervous system in the go, 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 fast pace. What's that called? Multitasking world. Right? To allow the mind and body to unify, to focus, to concentrate, to calm, and all of the states of consciousness that that kind of practice can bring, very helpful, be very useful, but that's not freedom. The other thing that I think important to say that freedom is not is, some people on this call know this old teacher of mine who used to talk about, it's not what he called the island where it all works out. That's not what freedom is. And that's kind of following the dog example, right? So what we imagine that freedom looks like is that I get all the good stuff and I get away from all the bad stuff, right? 24/7, you know, pleasant experience. And maybe on some other planet, that's possible. But here on planet Earth, that's not what freedom looks like. Because as we know, as we see, as we begin to see for ourselves in our meditation practice, moment by moment, we're being flooded with pleasant and unpleasant experience. So we may have for a period of time very pleasant experience, and if that happens, please enjoy. But if you're like most people, those pleasant experiences will be threaded through with plenty of unpleasant experience. And this is important because if you find yourself in meditation or in your life having unpleasant experience, I don't know how I can underscore this strongly enough. It's not your fault. This is the first noble truth, my friends, the first thing that the Buddha taught, that there's suffering in human life. He didn't say that because he was complaining. He said it because it's true, but most of us have a relationship to that, which is something like, who's to blame for this? Me? What am I doing wrong? Or who's messing things up in a way that's causing me to suffer like this? No, what the Buddha said is part of being human is that unpleasant experience arises. So if freedom isn't about having a certain experience, and it's not about getting to this fantasy island where everything works out just the way we want, then what is it? So I want to propose, and these are just words that you'll have to find a way to make real in your own experience to try this on, that what the Buddha is pointing to as freedom is a shift in our relationship to experience. It's not about getting a particular kind of experience. It's about shifting our relationship to our experience. I often say to people, you know, if you meditate, it doesn't mean you're going to get better content. That's what we think. You know, if I fill in the blank, I'll get better content. I'll have better experiences. That's not how it works. The world of causes and conditions, this web of interbeing that we live in, that we're part of. We engage in a world in which things are happening that are far beyond our doing. So we can do whatever we can to set up our life in a way that we minimize, you know, the extra suffering. That, as the Buddha talked about, we don't add extra arrows, right? We don't have to judge and criticize. We don't have to compare ourselves to other people. We don't have to. One of my old Zen teachers used to say, the whole of our practice can be summed up like this: not making things worse. It sounds like a kind of low bar, but it's not. It's actually quite profound, because we make things worse all the time. Pleasant experience comes, we try to hold on to it. Ouch. Why is it ouch? Because experience is changing and moving all the time. Joseph Goldstein, one of the founders of the insight meditation tradition in America, described dukkha, suffering, as rope burn. Kind of vivid, huh? There it is. We try to hold on to that which can't be held on to. I don't think you're getting another treat, my friend. Nope. He doesn't understand Buddhism yet. All right. So we suffer when we try to hold on. We also suffer when we try to push away, when we reject and we deny and we try to get rid of. Why? Because it's endless. If it worked, I would tell you to do it, right? The Buddha said, if it weren't possible, I wouldn't ask you to do it. The flip side is also true. If it was possible to have only pleasant experience 24/7, to live on that island where it all works out, if it were possible, I would say go for it. But it's not possible. And the fantasy that we carry, many of us unconsciously, the wish for that place, causes so much suffering, actually. So it's good to see it for what it is, as fantasy island, right? And to recognize that, no, we're here. We're here on planet Earth. And here on planet Earth, we don't get to say when or where or with whom we're going to have pleasant or unpleasant experience. We can do our best. What we can do, and what the practice is pointing us toward, is what I would call a radical reorienting. A radical shift in how we relate to our experience. And the most basic is that we stop this grasping and aversion. But let me walk you through these four foundations as a way to point toward some of the ways the practice itself is inviting us into this reorienting, right? So the first foundation of mindfulness that we started with, which is called rupa, is the body and breath. How is that a reorientation? Well, you know, most of us live up here, right? One of the great, there's a great story about an early Indian sage who came to America. And after he had toured around for a while, somebody asked him, you know, what do you think about American culture? And he said three words: lost in thought. So the first foundation is a pretty radical reorientation right out the gate. We're taking ourselves out of this, which you may have noticed is endless. Some of you may know this great word, papancha, means proliferation of mind. It kind of sounds like what it is, which is why I appreciate the word. So papancha. So immediately as we come into meditative practice, we're shifting out of the thinking into our direct experience, our somatic experience, our felt experience, our direct experience. First foundation. Second foundation is what I've already been talking about. It's called Vedana, this feeling tone. It's starting to notice every moment, pleasant or unpleasant. Actually, Vedana, there's three flavors: pleasant, unpleasant, what's called neither pleasant or unpleasant, neutral. Most of us don't notice neutral experience. They just call it boring. But we do notice pleasant and unpleasant. And when it's pleasant, this is how it works. This is basic Buddhist psychology 101. Pleasant, I like it, I want it, I try to get it. Hold on to it. Unpleasant, I don't like it, I don't want it. I try to reject it, push it away, deny it, get rid of it. This is the fundamental reverb in our system, that moment by moment, we're getting batted back and forth between liking and not liking, grasping and pushing away. And then we wonder why we're so tired. So the practice, this radical reorientation, isn't about getting better experience. It's about learning to notice the reactivity without fueling it, without running down those pathways, without imagining we really can get, that we really can get away from. Again, you could try that for a while, but it's endless. Why is it endless? Because experience keeps happening. Every moment, more, more, more. There's more experience, right? So this is the second foundation. The third foundation of mindfulness is what's called citta, mental states. And this includes all of our states of mind. And mind and heart in Buddhist understanding are the same, citta, heart, mind. So it includes our thoughts, our feelings, our fantasies, our dreams, our wishes, our plans, all of those states of mind. And if you sit even for a few minutes, you will quickly become aware of that papancha, of that proliferation of thought. Are you doing it? The key of noticing this third foundation of citta is it's really important to say we're not trying to get rid of our thoughts. I remember when I first went to the Zen monastery to live for a while. And I didn't know that I had this belief, but I've had the idea that when I got there, you know, it'd be so intense and quiet and I'd have all this support and that somehow my mind would be quiet. Ha! I was so disappointed. I remember in the first like week or so that I was there going to one of the old timers and just like bawling, you know, and saying, I thought that my mind would be quiet when I, you know, finally got myself here. And he just laughed, you know, because that's what we think. And again, it is possible. There are deep states of concentration in which the mind can get very quiet and sometimes stop, but it doesn't last. That's an experience. That's what Suzuki Roshi meant when he said, enlightenment is not an experience. You have that experience and then guess what? The next experience comes. Yeah. So we reorient with this third foundation by similarly not grasping or pushing away, not believing or trying to get rid of our thoughts. And maybe most importantly with citta, it's that we begin to not identify with our thoughts. Because we do, don't we? We hold so tightly to our beliefs, our opinions, our points of view. And again, you don't have to get rid of them. Just don't hold on so tightly. If we look around at the state of the world, what do we see? Views and opinions just banging up against each other, right? Violently banging up against each other. This is not a small thing. Why are they violently banging up against each other? Because they are being held like fists. There's no softening. There's no curiosity. There's no wonder. There's just, this is my view and my opinion, and I'm holding on to it. Bang. Just that. just that loosening, that willingness to disidentify, even a little bit, would go such a long way in unraveling the pain of the world. And finally, we have the fourth foundation of mindfulness, which if you are like me, if you're an insight meditation teacher who teaches retreats, it's a bit of a conundrum because how to teach it. Because the fourth foundation of mindfulness is a bunch of lists. It's the Four Noble Truths and the Three Characteristics and the Seven Factors of Awakening and the Eightfold Path. What? How are you supposed to teach that as meditation? So I've been sitting with this question for, I don't know, a few decades. And my current feeling about it is that what that fourth foundation is pointing to is not so much the moment-to-moment experience of a breath, of a unpleasant sensation, of a thought, or a feeling. It's not the individual, it's the collective. It's the looking at how things interrelate. It's patterns of experience. Patterns of experience is what, as we sit and settle and get more and more quiet, we begin to see how things actually work, right? And this is true at an individual level. We begin to see our own, we would call it, our own karmic patterning. You know? Example I like to give is that I have noticed in myself that my emotional body is one that reacts very quickly with anger. And as I've paid attention over time, I've noticed that almost always, right under the surface of the anger, there's hurt. That's an example, it's a simple example, but a powerful one, right? Of a personal karmic pattern, right? And we come by those karmic patterns honestly. We inherit them from our families, from our culture, from our language, from the world we grow up in. We don't have to blame ourselves for them, but when we see them clearly, there's some freedom because we don't have to keep acting them out. This is a shift in relationship, right? And in the same way we can see personal patterning, we can also begin to see the pattern of how the world is, how reality is shaped. Right? So the example I used in the meditation practice, which is a good one, a good place to start, is we notice the truth of impermanence. We start to see for ourselves this pattern of reality, which is that everything is coming and going. That we can see in our own experience something, a thought, a sound, a sensation can arise and fade, and arise and fade. It's not a theory. It's a description of how things are. So this fourth foundation is pointing us to how things are. And each of these, all four of these, are giving us an opportunity, giving us an opportunity to reorient, to shift our relationship to, right? So that rather than being caught in, right? Rather than being caught in the mind and lugging the body around as if it's some kind of, you know, thing that we have to take care of in order to get done whatever it is we think is so important to get done, instead of automatically being in this reactivity of pleasant and unpleasant, instead of automatically believing and clinging to and insisting upon our ideas and our beliefs and our opinions. Instead of being caught in our patterns, we can begin to see them all clearly. And in that clarity, there's freedom. Mindfulness begets choicefulness. This is from Viktor Frankl, who many of you know was a author of the book Man's Search for Meaning. And I find his words hold a lot of potency because of the fact that he lived through the Holocaust. He lived through life in concentration camps. So he wasn't saying what he said out of an easy life. He had really struggled and seen sort of the worst of us as humans. And yet, he said, between stimulus and response, there is a space. Stimulus means experience comes in. Between a stimulus and our response to that stimulus, there is a space. In that space is freedom. This is what we practice for. We practice so that in that space, we can begin to reorient our habitual reactivity. We can begin to align our behavior, our responses, with what we care about, not just our karmic conditioning. He also said, this is important, everything can be taken from us. Everything can be taken from us, but one thing, our last human freedom is to choose our attitude in any given situation. And he's speaking from experience. This was how he survived the horrors of what he survived, was by a shift in his orientation. And this is what our practice is pointing us to. So I want to say one more piece, because so far I've just talked about this in relationship to the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, which is a very useful way to explore it. But there is another piece, and this, for me, in any case, comes a bit from my Zen training. And that is that in addition to the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, these are all content of our experience, different dimensions of content, right? I said at the beginning, there's awareness, there's the content of awareness, and there's the relationship between. So far, I've mostly been talking about different kinds of content. The Four Foundations of Mindfulness are all different dimensions of the content of our experience, the body and breath, the feeling tone, the mental states, and patterns of experience. Those are all ways of describing content. And say, I've been saying that what we're doing is shifting our relationship to the content from being reactive to responsive, from being habitual to being infused with a sense of intentionality and choice. But there's one more part, which is over here. This is awareness itself. And what happens over time, oh, it showed me raising my hand. As we practice over time, as we begin to loosen up, you know, the tangle of our habitual reactivity, as we begin to learn to relate to our experience differently, we begin to have the possibility of leaning into awareness itself. We stop identifying so thoroughly with our experience in a way that allows us to lean back, to rest back into awareness. And what is that? In Zen, we say, even the 10,000 sages don't know. We know in the West, we've merged science and spirituality. Buddhism is overlaid by our sort of scientific worldview. And science knows a lot about the brain. But even for science, consciousness, awareness is a great mystery. We can't know it with the familiar cognitive mind, because we are it. So this is the doorway that opens as we practice over time. We stop just noticing the content moving through the sky, and we start to recognize we are the sky. And that, my friends, is real freedom. So I have one more piece that I was going to read, but I think I'll pause and maybe read it at the end and see. I've said a lot, and thank you for your little floating emojis. But please, if anyone has a question or a comment, you can actually, I think you can raise your hand by the little thing at the bottom, or you can type something into a chat and Caroline will read it. And I would be really happy to respond to anything that any of you want to say or ask. Like Victoria. Can you unmute, Caroline? Can you unmute? Oh, there you go. There you go. Okay, thank you.
I'm so grateful to see you and be live with you, so to speak, today. I was just wondering if you could speak to the relationship between truth and freedom.
Oh, such a good question. The relationship between truth and freedom. Well, my sort of instant answer is that truth is the doorway to freedom. That the only way that we find our way to freedom is through the truth. Right? And truth has different dimensions to it, right? So in the insight tradition, we call it insight because it's said that the insights are what bring awakening, are what bring freedom. And what are we having insight into? Well, we're having insight into we're seeing the true nature of various things, right? That's what insight means. So there is a kind of truth or insight that happens from, the Buddha described it this way, there's truth that comes from listening. And he came from an oral tradition. So for us, that would mean, for example, you may read something or listen to something and have, oh, true, right? There's some resonance for you. That insight gets deepened, that truth is deepened when we do some self-reflection. So for example, I talked about impermanence as a universal truth, right? As a universal characteristic. So you may hear me talk about impermanence and go, oh, right, that's really true. Everything is impermanent. But that truth will deepen significantly if you or any of you take it on and chew on it and consider it and reflect on it and start to see how it's actually true in your own life. One of my favorite ways to do this is to periodically take note of my feelings throughout the day. You know, here I'm irritated, here I'm sleepy, here I'm contented, here I'm sad, here. And then at the end of the day, I look through the list and then I say, Where are all those feelings now? This is me reflecting on the truth of experience in my own experience. It's pretty easy to do if you are noticing getting older. That's one of the great reflections on impermanence, right? So we have hearing about it, we have reflecting on it, and then, and this is where meditative practice is so useful, we can observe and experience the truth in our direct experience. You can have a moment in which you see a sensation in the body arise and make some noise, and then it goes away. Actually, one of the best places to notice this in meditation is with sound. You can have the direct experience of the impermanence of things in your meditative experience. And it's understood that that level of truth, that seeing things for yourself in your direct experience, is really where the transformational freeing capacity of truth comes. So that was a long answer, but I don't know where you went on the screen, but I hope it was helpful. There you are, Victoria. Thank you. Yeah. I'm going to take one Nai Hua. I see a yellow flower and a hand raised. Can you? Please.
Like your teachings make me feel very clear, but sometimes if I was alone, how to practice those awareness, just being yourself?
Yeah, so the question was, listening to the teachings, it feels very clear, but how to practice by oneself. So you may all notice that it's hard to practice alone, isn't it? That's why we come together in places like this, where we gather and support one another. And in the Buddha's time, people practice together in sangha, in community, because we can help each other out in that way. And what I would say is, if you can find places like this to go and be supported, maybe once a week, maybe once a month, maybe every day, as much as you need, that's super helpful. And if you can't, because as I was saying before, you know, we don't have, there were things that the Buddha didn't have that we do, like this, like the internet. So it's possible to listen to Dharma talks all the time. You could listen to a Dharma talk every day. If you go to my website, you'll hear lots and lots of Dharma talks. So please feel free. They're there for you if you want. It's my name. And you go and you can download Dharma talks. They're all for free. So I hope that that will help you. Thank you. I'm going to take one more from Erin, and then we'll go to the questions that may be coming in the chat. Please.
Hi. Thank you so much for this. I have so many what society would say are horrible things happening to me at this time, like the last couple of months, losing my family, a divorce, but other stuff. I volunteer at an Indian reservation where all the women are addicted to fentanyl, and I hear their stories, and it's all I can do not to cry in front of them, but I go home and get under the covers. Anyway, when we did the exercise, the awareness of awareness, which I've done before, what happened to me, and I'd like to know if this is freedom. So at first I'm feeling, you know, what the woman told me. I'm wondering if the person, my guest, is actually going to show up. I'm wondering about financial stuff. All this is going through my head, and I'm feeling it in my body in this tightness. And I did what you said. It was kind of a deep breathing cosmic orbit kind of thing. And it went away. And then when you said, where is the awareness? What happened to me is, first of all, those feelings they went away. No problem. You know, I've been practicing that for quite a while. But what happened to me with the awareness of awareness, my experience was my awareness, or the awareness, was what you were talking about. I mean, it was, I'm looking at the sky and the sun and palm trees and flowers and animals. And this woodpecker was just having a ball, which was making me laugh during the meditation. And I felt like the freedom was that all of this has awareness. Maybe it had my awareness, but it's not my awareness. It's actually, to me, it's cosmic, to sound like a
Yeah,
dork.
so what I hear is that I was describing freedom as a radical reorientation. And most of the time, for most of us, our orientation is that the center of the universe is located right here, and it's looking out from behind our eyes. And sometimes there can be a shift in that, and we recognize, oh no, everything else is looking in at me. Everything else is holding me. This is a great gift. So I would just encourage you to enjoy it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
Yeah.
I felt there was a breeze and I was like, it's breathing me. I really
Yes.
felt that. And you know, I'm no 25-year experienced
Yep.
meditator. This stuff
Yep.
just, if I practice, it happens. So
Well, the reason
thank
that
you.
it happens, the reason that it happens for you or for any of us is because awareness is always here. We get distracted, we look away, we get involved with other things, but it's always here. My husband does this little trick when he teaches meditation, and he says, stop being aware. No, really, stop. Stop it right now. Just stop.
Thank you.
So, right. So when we recognize something that's always here in this way, it allows us to lean back a little bit, right? It allows us to stop trying so hard. It allows us a sense of ease, even when things are really difficult. And I'm sorry that things are really difficult for you at this moment. Yeah.
I
Yeah.
have
Thank you.
thank God for meditation and thank you, Pamela.
You're welcome. Do you have anything, Caroline, before we from the online? Yeah.
Yes, there are a couple of questions here. So there's one from Linda. She says, thank you so much. I wonder, would you say if enlightenment isn't an experience, that it is an attitude or a process, or is it something else?
Well, my languaging for today is that awakening, enlightenment, freedom is an attitude, but it is for most of us a reorientation. Because our familiar attitudes are, you know, to use the sort of fancy Buddhist language, they're dualistic. Our usual attitude is, I'm over here and you're over there, and that's how it is. And this radical reorientation, similar to what Aaron was describing, is sometimes things just go whoop and we realize, oh, we're surprised. So it is an attitude, it's a shift in attitude, but that shift is not so much something that we can make happen. It's more like we can open ourselves, we can let go of some of our familiar attitudes and ideas and beliefs and things that we cling to. And in that opening, we allow ourselves to be surprised. There's space for something else to come in. And at least for me, that when those shifts happen, they're almost always a surprise. Oh, like that. And there's not just one, it's important to say. This is available moment by moment, right? And sometimes they're really big shifts in orientation, and sometimes they're very small. And sometimes the small ones are more potent than the big ones. So don't wish for the big ones. You may end up somewhat debilitated for a while if that happens. It's actually a kindness to allow oneself to be infused in a slow and ongoing way with being surprised. Yeah. Thank you, whoever asked. Yeah, Linda. There another one, Caroline?
Yeah, so there's one from Adrian, and he asks, so we break the circle of pushing what we don't like and holding pleasure in those spaces between thoughts by meditation.
Is that a question?
Yes, is a question mark at the end. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. So, what I was just describing as the pushing away what we don't want and the trying to hold on to and grab what we do want, that is our habit. We're not even doing it, right? You're not actively doing it. It's just happening all the time. Like for me, I'm very sound sensitive. So there's a sound that happens outside. My whole body goes, ugh. I didn't exactly do that, but that was my habitual reaction, right? You smell something, whatever your favorite smell is, fresh cut grass, baking bread, chocolate cookies, something, you smell it and you just automatically, right? That habitual tug and pull is habitual and it's also conditioned, meaning what I find pleasant may be different than what you find pleasant, but we all have that same reactivity all the time. And in meditation, we get to see the reactivity rather than being reactive. In other words, we become aware of the reactivity. This is a simple way of saying we become the sky. And in the sky, we see the storms and the sun and the wind and the airplanes. We see we're with all of it. We don't have to get rid of any of it, but we're also not upset by it. We can allow it to be it as it is. And it's really important to say, because I started off talking about, the state of things, our shared life in the Saha world. It's really important to say that what I'm pointing to is not passivity. This is not, oh, well, somebody else is suffering over there, but I can just kind of bliss out on my own little cloud over here. No. This is non-reactivity. It is one of my favorite Zen stories. Is a student who comes to his teacher at the end of his teacher's life. So his teacher's dying, and the teacher comes to pay his appreciation. And he comes to him and asks a question. He says, "What is the teaching of your entire lifetime?" I always think, man, this old guy's dying. Like, come on, give him a break. But actually, it's a kind question. This student is a disciple, he's devoted to his teacher and he wants to make sure that he understands like what was the essence of his teacher's dharma so that he can get it right and pass it on. What is the teaching of your entire lifetime? And I always think the guy could say anything, bottomless wisdom, endless compassion, moment to moment insight, et cetera. But he doesn't say any of that. He says, what is the teaching of your entire lifetime? An appropriate response. An appropriate response is what we're looking for. It's not passivity. It's not reactivity. It's being able to respond from freedom, not from just, kind of a knee-jerk, whatever our usual is. Because we've been talking about a lot what our usual is, grasping and aversion, grasping and aversion. What's the Buddha called? What's the middle path between those? And that middle path is not something that we step on and then we go on cruise control. No, we're stepping, stepping, stepping each moment, each breath, all along the way. All right. I'm gonna leave you with a poem which I wanted to read because I think it's great. It's a great, I hope I have it. It's a great example of what I've been trying to talk about, which is this reorientation that meditative practice can bring. You ready? This is called Another Reason Why I Don't Keep a Gun in the House. It's by Billy Collins. He says, the neighbor's dog will not stop barking. He's barking the same high rhythmic bark that he barks every time they leave the house. They must switch him on their way out. You hear a little bit of unpleasant aversion in this, right? The neighbor's dog will not stop barking. I close all the windows in the house and put on a Beethoven symphony full blast, but I can still hear him muffled under the music, barking, barking, barking. Here's the turn. And now I can see him sitting in the orchestra, his head raised confidently as if Beethoven had included a part for barking dog. When the record finally ends, he is still barking, sitting there in the oboe section, barking, his eyes fixed on the conductor who is entreating him with his baton, while the other musicians listen in respectful silence to the famous barking dog solo, that endless coda that first established Beethoven as an innovative genius. So let's sit just for a moment and do a little dedication, sharing of merit. Wow, this is just psychedelic over here, all this. These hearts and stars and screens. Thank you all. All right. So just inviting us each to take a moment to close your eyes and take a breath. And just feel in to what's present, what's here, what's true for you now. And then offering up any goodness, any inspiration, any place in you that may have been touched or moved or awakened. Opening our hands, opening our hearts, sending it out, extending out all of the goodness that we have cultivated by gathering together here on this Sunday with Sangha Live, and sending it out into the world by the power and truth of our practice together. May we, together with all beings, be free from suffering, and may we all awaken and be free.